Hello and welcome to another instalment of NCA Chats with myself and Chris Heal. We are delighted today to be joined by Bill Sweeney, CEO of the Rugby Football Union. We're going to be talking to Bill about his visions and thoughts about the community game. But first of all, we'll just start off with a quite easy and simple. Bill, how are you?
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Joe. Hope you're well.
Yeah, all very good. And Chris, we'll just get a word from you because obviously we're not sure when we're going to hear from you lots today.
It's brilliant to have Bill on the show today. I mean, his tray's piled high at the moment, and he's, you know, decided to come on and have a chat about the community game. And to be honest, when he said yes to us, I wasn't surprised at all, because Mike Brennan, who obviously we work closely with, and Alan McCready as well at the NCA, spoke so highly of Bill and his passion for the community game. And Bill has obviously spoken about sort of the game being the lifeblood of the sport in press conferences, where I've pestered him about what he thinks the community game should look like. So just on that, Bill, to begin with, if you don't mind, you've mentioned it's the lifeblood of the sport. So why is it, do you think it's so important to the sport that we do take such an interest in the community game as well as the grassroots game?
Just from a practical point of view, if you look at what the RFU is, the RFU is a membership organisation. So the official definition of it is a cooperative a company that services its members. So we have an obligation to look after our membership, and our membership are the 1,450, actually it's 2,000 total, but 1,450 voting clubs across the community. So we have an obligation to service them, look after them. But I think it goes deeper than that. If you've played the game, and you know, we might come on to this, but I've played for four rugby clubs in my time in three different countries, and there's something unique and special about community rugby and the values of rugby. And it really is the lifeblood of the sport. You know, if you don't have a thriving community game, then you don't have the pipeline of players coming through. You don't have those players going into academies and then going on to play for Premiership clubs and then going on to represent England. So, you know, that it's a bit of a sort of a cycle. But I tend to start with a community game. If you don't have a community game, you don't have the right players there, you don't have a game, full stop.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more on that, Bill. And you mentioned there that you've been affiliated with four clubs when you've been playing the game. Is that kind of also hammer home your ambition to help the community game grow in your role as CEO of the RFU?
Yeah, it really does. You know, when I took this job on, what is it now, 14 months ago, and you come into the RFU, and of course you've got the internationals at Twickenham, and you've got the privilege to go to a World Cup, and you know, and you're interacting and you're talking to Eddie on a regular basis, and you meet the players, and that's the glamorous side of things, and that's the really, you know, the elite aspect of the game. To be honest with you, the bit I enjoy the most, and I made a pledge when I first came on, was to go every Saturday, was to try and go to a community game as opposed to a professional game. So I tend to go to level three and below. And when you go around the country, wherever it is, whether it's in Yorkshire or Lancashire or Surrey or wherever, the values are the same, the atmosphere is the same, the spirit's the same. And the camaraderie in a rugby club and the commitment and the passion that goes into it and what it does for that local community, for me, that's the most inspiring and the main reason why I do the job.
Yeah, and I think Bill Beaumont will probably echo those words as well, Bill, because he's always at Fylde, I've noticed, on a Saturday afternoon. So, and I mean, if I'm right in saying as well, Bill, you're affiliated with both Rosden Park and Richmond, who are two of the teams fighting it right out the top of National One this year.
Yeah, there's a bit of a myth about Richmond. I mean, Richmond's my closest club, and a lot of players I used to play against are now at Richmond or moved to Richmond, so I tend to go there quite a bit, but I never played for them. Actually, I started off my rugby life at the age of 11 in Birkenhead. And then my parents were living abroad, and they came back and they took me out and they put me into a football playing school. I didn't really like football, but I wasn't bad at it. So I ended up playing for Chelsea, and then I played for English universities for 3 years. But then the moment I didn't turn pro, and when I finished university, I switched straight back to rugby. So my first job, my first graduate trainee job, was up in Aberdeen, actually, with Shell in the oil industry. And I joined Aberdeenshire Rugby Club, and within 24 hours, you've got a second family. And they welcome you, even though you're English. You know, you used to get a lot of stick taken out of me and whatever. But, you know, I played for Aberdeenshire for a couple of years. Really good club, great atmosphere. I think I got transferred to the Middle East. And I played for the Abu Dhabi Rugby Club, which is an incredibly good club. You know, three junior All Blacks played for us. We had a Sussex County prop. We won the Bahrain 15s tournament. I ended up being treasurer of that club. So I had 4 years there. And then I returned home. And my first club was Rosslyn Park. So I joined Rosslyn Park. Some friends were playing there. And then married, kids came along. It's actually relevant in terms of what's going on in the community game today. But a bit of pressure from the family in terms of don't travel so much and let's find a more local club. And that's where I ended up playing for a club called Weybridge Vandals, who who are a decent side. I think they were level, what would have been 6-7, I think, at that stage. But in every case, wherever you went, the camaraderie and the spirit was pretty similar wherever you went. And for me, if you're traveling and you're working and you're moving around the country or moving internationally, if you want to really stabilize yourself and have a good network of friends and a support network, join a rugby club. And I've got friends from rugby now that are lifelong friends. I was talking to some yesterday who were back in New Zealand from Abu Dhabi, and you never lose them. So for me, the community game, it's more than a game, isn't it? I mean, it's a way of life, and it's a network of lifelong friends.
Yeah, and in terms of it being a way of life, Bill, you know, I'm sure all these community clubs are itching to get back playing, but obviously when it's safe to do so, and I know I was on the call the other week with you and Steve Granger, and you kind of mapped out what was the next stages for the community game, and I know the three possible windows have been outlined as well this week in terms of when the National Leagues and the community game might return. I mean, how confident are you of maybe hitting those windows, or is it a case, again, Bill, of waiting to see what happens in terms of this COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, we all got our fingers crossed. We had a professional game board meeting this morning, which was talking about return to train and return to play protocols for the professional game and issues around testing. And obviously the professional game will lead the way in terms of how quickly we can get back and play. But things are clearly loosening up. I mean, I had a lot of videos sent to me on Monday from clubs that have returned to groups of six at training sessions, some using a ball, some not using a ball. So things are loosening up there. We've got those three windows, September, November and January. I've still got my fingers crossed for September in the assumption that we don't get a massive spike or a second wave. Like, you know, we're seeing a little bit of that at Leicester now. But I'm still keeping my fingers crossed for September. To do that, we've got to be in full face-to-face contact training by the beginning of August. So that window's closing, but it's not impossible. And we know, and I know from conversations with the clubs, they're just desperate to open their clubhouses, you know, just to get the takings going again, to get the bar working again, to get the minis and juniors back. And we're really worried that if we don't get those back as soon as possible, you run the risk of losing a generation of rugby players who find other things to do, or they just forget the habit of playing rugby. So we can't get back quick enough as long as it's safe to do so.
Yeah, of course. And I'm aware of rugby clubs in my local area of Staffordshire that are literally reopening as soon as is humanly possible. So on Saturday, they're going straight back in. And obviously, that's an important side of it, isn't it? There's the money aspect of what's taken in the clubhouses, and, you know, because there's so much revenue generated there. And, you know, you've announced that there's a support fund available to clubs that if they are struggling, or if, you know, they're finding things a bit harder than maybe they thought they would at the start of it all. You've offered that as a result of COVID-19. Is it important to you to help these clubs, you know, even more than what the RFU announced initially?
We'll do whatever we can do. And we set up that support fund, I think, within 3 days of going into lockdown. We were quite surprised at the relatively low take-up of that loan to begin with. And I think that's because a lot of the game is really well run. And the clubs reacted quickly. They went into mothballing their operations, reducing their costs, making sure they could keep going. So they actually responded pretty well themselves. So the number of applications we had was relatively low. But we're entering into a season now, which is a really important part of the year for clubs. You know, it's the hosting of weddings, it's the hosting of social events, it's, you know, coming into pre-season training and all the rest of it. So that fund has remained open. And if there are any clubs that start to feel some real hardship during this period, then it's still available for them to access.
And also, Bill, and those announcements as well, has it been really key for you guys and Steve as well to give clarity to a lot of these clubs moving forward? Because I know it's very tough to put timescale on things, but now you've been able to outline this support fund and outline the three possible windows. That must be very good for you to be able to say, well, this is the clarity that the clubs are craving at the moment.
Yeah, it's probably one of the biggest roles that we have right now is trying to provide whatever clarity we can in a really uncertain environment. You know, there's so much unpredictability out there, so, and you can't be 100% certain, but we've got to try and provide as much clarity as we can. And communications plays a massive role in that. So we've set up regular web sessions. We've set up regular links and contact places on our site, so you can access the latest information, whether it's return to play, whether it's accessing your local authority in terms of grants and subsidies and support that the local authority can give. And we think that's absolutely critical at this moment in time. You can't over-communicate right now. So it's how much information can we give the clubs to give them some kind of support in terms of how they're managing their situation.
And just to sort of go back to something you mentioned before, Bill, if you don't mind, about that camaraderie of these community clubs. And yes, we know how financially tough it's been for them at the moment. And, you know, clubs are struggling to generate any income. But how pleasing is it for you as the CEO of the RFU to see some of the community work these guys have done? Because I know Barnes Rugby Club had the big lift a few months ago, and Old Albanian and Cambridge have been doing their own thing as well. But these clubs have really been proactive during this time to help those in need.
No, it's absolutely brilliant. And it makes you feel... Not just proud, but it makes you feel really privileged to have this role in the RFU and to do what we can to support them. I was actually on a Barnes web session last night. So they had a Q&A session, and it went on for about an hour and 15 minutes. They're a really active rugby club, so that was good. I did a Met Police rugby club. They had their annual dinner virtually, so I did that, you know, in the hope that, you know, if I ever get done for speeding, I might get a bit of a relief or something. But that club was really good. Great section, very ambitious. Wensleydale up in Yorkshire doing some incredible things as well. I went on to a webcast also with Sevenoaks the other day, and some of the things they're doing. But you can't really single out one club. I mean, they're just massive hubs for the community, and the stuff they're doing around supporting the NHS, raising money through charitable events. You saw that Barnes Big Lift initiative. 35 England players ended up signing onto that, which is incredible, and it went global. You look at what goes on with food banks. You look at what goes on in terms of contacting and communicating with elderly people who are shielded. You know, just the stories just pour into us in terms of what these clubs are doing in the local community. And it just makes you really proud to be associated with a sport that does so much good.
Is it important for you, Bill, as well? You mentioned being on calls with clubs around the country, and I know you were part of the AGM for the NCA a couple of weeks ago. Is it important for you to be a part of that and listen into conversations, or have your view as well as the RFU CEO?
Yeah, it really is. And one of the positives that's come out of this whole situation is that we've been forced to have more direct interaction with the clubs. And, you know, people now have got used to using Skype and Zoom and Microsoft Teams and all the rest of it. So you can have that interaction on a regular basis. And Steve Grange is very active. He does a couple of webinars a week as well. But there are so many issues going on in the game at the moment. You know, you've got the adult 15s competition review. And like most things in rugby, there's no right or wrong answer. And everyone's got a point of view. So you have to have that debate. And it really helps to listen to what people are saying in the game. And what I've found out, particularly through direct contact, is you look at that adult comp review that's going on at the moment, and what's right for a National 1 team in the NCA, what's right for them might not be right for a Level 7 team. So if you're playing National 1 rugby, you want to travel. You want to go on a four-hour coach ride. You want to get back late at night. You want to compete at the highest level. You want to get promoted. You want to push yourself as far as you can go. But then you go along to a club who's Level 7, Level 8, and they're saying, look, I've got two kids. I used to play serious rugby, but there's a limited number of games I want to play. And actually, I don't want to get promoted because that means more travel. I just want to stay in my region, and it needs to fit into my lifestyle. And we've got this, we've always got this pressure on participation rates, and we're probably doing better than most sports, but that adult male 15s part of the game is under increasing pressure. So how do we make the game relevant to today's society so that we can really protect it? And what you learn is actually there's no one size fits all answer. What's right for level 3 might be totally different for what's right for level 7, level 8. And it's only by talking to the game that you really understand that. If you develop that policy in a vacuum, you're going to upset too many people. So it's difficult because, as I say, you're never going to please everybody. But unless if you don't talk to people and get their opinions, you're just not going to be well enough informed.
Yeah, and on that, Bill, in terms of talking and communicating with people to enforce change in the game as well, I know the RFU have taken a strong stance on over diversity and inclusion in the sport, especially over the last few weeks. And is it important for you guys to see that across all levels of the game as well as the top of the game?
Yeah, it really is. You know, you look at the England squad that went to Japan, and you've got 35% Black African minority ethnic there. You know, the most diverse team we've ever had. And you look at some of the real star players, and they've come from that background. And I know myself from my Olympic days, the British Olympic Association does a really good job of talent ID in cities and inner cities. And you've got a fantastic athletic pool there. And we're not accessing them enough. You know, where do we get the next Ellis Genge? Where do we get the next Carl Sinclair? Where does the next Courtney Laws come from? So we want to make our game much more accessible from a playing point of view, not just because it's the right thing to do, which it is, but also from a selfish point of view, it's going to broaden our access to great skills so we can compete at the highest level. So you've got that piece. But then you look at that diversity mix of the team, And then you go to the administration of the game, and the fact we've only got one black female member on a 62-person council, and we don't have a minority ethnic representation on our board. And you look at that and you say, well, actually, it's just not good enough, because if we are going to expand the game, if we are going to broaden the accessibility, that has to be reflected in the boardroom, and it's got to be reflected in the administration of the game. Now, when someone asks that question, I think there's kind of an implied feeling or intent that there's something going on to prevent that happening, and the RFU is against that. That's not the case. But what we've got to do is we've got to broaden the candidate pool that we can select from for these positions within the administration side. So how do you get more young female minority ethnic people who are involved in the game as volunteers? How do you get them to say, actually, I can play a bigger role in the RFU, I can play a bigger role in my constituent body? How do we encourage them? One small thing we're looking at actually is saying, well, perhaps to give them the confidence to do it is we identify a number of people around the country who've got aspirations to do that, and we invite them to come in and sit on a board meeting. Or one of the board members who's a board member for another company, they act as a sort of a mentor, and they take them along to board meetings of their company so people can get to see and understand this is what you need to do to play a bigger role. But you know, the gestures and the words are easy. It's how you actually have the actions and process in place to really make a difference. But we're really committed to it. It's not just lip service. It's a key pillar of our strategy going forward.
That's obviously wonderful to hear. And obviously, we'll go back to national leagues now. Very close to wrapping it up, and we can leave you to your probably far more important things than talking to myself and Chris. What direction do you feel like the national league is going in? Because obviously, we've seen such engagement from the communities since COVID-19. Do you think it's going in a positive and really good direction?
Yeah, I do think so. You know, there was a very controversial decision we took a while ago around the funding for the championship. And we just felt that the gulf between the Premiership and the Championship was getting bigger and bigger, regardless of the money we were putting in. And frankly, there isn't enough money in the game to fund a fully professionalised Tier 2 of rugby. We'd probably have to put in about at least $25 million to make that happen. We just can't afford to do that. When you think what $25 million would do to the community game, the money's just not there. And as I say, I go to quite a few National 1 games. I did do last season. And the quality of play is really good. You know, it's very open play, it's very athletic, it's very young, it's predominantly English players playing in it. So you look at the quality of play there, and I think what you'll see now in the Championship, and you saw this with the deal between Northampton and Bedford, which we think is a great approach, because that's going to give academy players more game time, they're going to be English, and they're going to be playing in decent competition. But I can see that gap between National 1 and Championship closing now and getting closer. The other thing, and John Inverdale I know is totally committed to this, you know, we need to encourage people to come into the game. And if they want to invest money into the game in National 1, we would certainly support and encourage that. But it doesn't just need to be about the payment of players. It needs to be about improving facilities as well. So what are the minimum standards in terms of pitch, clubhouse, floodlights, a women's team? You've got to run a Colts team. So any money you're putting into the club needs to be split equally between payment of players, but also developing a legacy that's going to be good for the game. And I think National 1 and 2 are absolutely critical for that. You know, it's in the term. You know, they're national, so they're travelling around the country. They're a great showcase for how rugby should be played. And you've got a tremendous community atmosphere and spirit in there. You know, I was at Rosslyn Park a couple of times this year. You know, I left at about 11 o'clock at night, and the clubhouse was still booming. So you know, it seems to embody all the right values of the game. And you know, we just want to see it continue to grow.
Yeah, and obviously John Inverdale recently announced as the chairman of the NCA. What's your relationship with him, and how does he interact with you, kind of with his new role?
So I knew him prior to that. I mean, not massively, but obviously being in sport, and he's heavily involved in sport. And when I was at the Weybridge Vandals, you know, we used to play against Esher, and he's heavily involved with Esher. Terrible club, but there you go. But he's really heavily involved in Esher. He's played at all sorts of different levels. He's probably been an administrator in the game for, I don't know, maybe 30 years or so. But he's a very open-minded free thinker. And I think at the moment we need people in the game who respect the traditions of the game, which he does, but realize that actually we probably need to make certain changes in some areas to keep it relevant and to keep it contemporary. So we're really pleased that John's come in. He's got big shoes to fill after Norman Robertson. You know, Norman was a great servant for the NCA, and you know, a really important member on our council. And he's given me a lot of advice in the year I've been involved in the RFU, and he won't go away. I mean, he'll still be there. So a closer relationship with John is really important in terms of what's happening with the NCA and how can we work together in terms of the overall strategy for rugby going forward.
Well, no, and kind of that was kind of it. So firstly, Bill, we want to say thank you very much for your time, for joining us today. It's massively appreciated, and we hope everyone watching and listening thinks the same. You can follow NCA Rugby at NCA underscore rugby on Twitter, at NCA Rugby on Instagram, and just type in NCA Rugby into Facebook, you'll find us there. And if you want to find the website, it's just ncarugby.com. And yeah, thank you very much for watching, and I'm sure we'll see you next time.
All right, keep doing it. Keep up the good work, and we've got a great game. We just need to protect it a bit.
Absolutely, Bill. Thanks very much for your time, Bill. Really appreciate it.